the Bodhisattva ideal. There are antinomies in any religion. Note, antinomy is a philosophical term, meaning the mutual incompatibility of two laws. In Christianity, we have the dichotomy of God's foreknowledge of events and man's free will. And in other religions, we have others equally insoluble. Insoluble, that is, on the ground of the principles accepted by their adherents, but not ultimately insoluble. The spirit of man, finding in itself a deeper and wider knowledge, a more profound experience, is driven to formulate its religious postulates anew, is driven to transcend ground on which antinomies were possible. And, soaring in the wide ether of his inmost being, looks down and sees them as the related halves of a greater truth. In Buddhism we find many such antinomies, and it is the endeavour to transcend these, always in harmony with the inmost spirit of the Buddha's teaching, that constitutes the history of Buddhist thought. One such antinomy is that of grace and works. It was revived in Europe in the Middle Ages, and at a later date, during the Reformation, and is already familiar to us in the controversies of Luther, Calvin, and the Zwinglius, with the orthodoxy of the Catholic Church. An efflorescence of sects shows life in a religion. Only orthodoxy is dead. Discussion promotes growth. Bearing this in mind, we will not harshly condemn those who differ from ourselves in matters of religion or in anything else, but will endeavour to realise this, that a thing is as true as its opposite. Thus, we will admit our opponents to be as right as ourselves, and grasping our own limited truth in one hand and theirs in the other, we'll fit them together and see how marvellously they correspond. Thus, we shall attain to a larger conception of truth. This is the middle way of Buddhism. Mahayana has long held to this principle. It recognises the truth of what Hinayanists teach, even though the latter assert that their brethren of the larger vehicle have gone far astray from the teaching of the Buddha. It classes the whole of its own speculations in the body of relative truth, allowing only the most fundamental principles of Buddhism, those unquestionably taught by the Blessed One himself, principles shared alike by the adherents of the greater and lesser vehicles, to be classed as absolute truth. The Arhat ideal of Hinayana and the Bodhisattva ideal of Mahayana may seem at first sight to be such an antinomy as we refer to. Indoctrinated as we are with the Buddhism of Burma, Siam and Ceylon, where the lesser vehicle flourishes, we can hardly be expected to see them as the mutually complementary halves of a greater truth, a truth which, indeed, is the core of Buddhism. But such they are. The greater the cleavage between them, the greater will be the truth on which they both rest, in which they live and move and have their being. The wider asunder are the shores of continents, the greater is that portion of the globe which supports them. These ideals of human life, for such they are, rest upon two different concepts of salvation, and ultimately of the universe itself. Alan W. Watts has expressed it much better than I possibly can. Quote, because the Buddha denied the existence of any self-nature in the person, the Hinayana takes this to mean that there is no self at all, self with a capital S. The Mahayana, on the other hand, considers that a true self, capital S, is found when the false one is renounced. From The Spirit of Zen, page 21. And on page 22, he says, quote, the Mahayana therefore affirms life by declaring that all things are the self, capital S, instead of denying it by saying only that in each thing taken separately there is no self. Yet fundamentally, there is no disagreement on this point between Mahayana and Hinayana. The difference is that the former goes further than the latter. The Arhat, the ideal man of the limited Buddhism of the Pali Canon, or rather of the philosophy derived therefrom, is content with his own realization of his own emptiness, his lack of self-nature, anatta. His own salvation accomplished, desire subdued, truth realized, or at least a part of it, we would add, he sits back on his seat of the sacred Kusha grass and enjoys the bliss of his nirvana. Not so the Bodhisattva. His salvation is the salvation of all sentient beings. He in them and they in him, a mutual interpenetration of being. This is his ideal. Quote, may there be no root of good in me, no knowledge of right, no cunning or skill, save such as serve all sentient beings. End of quote. Quote is from the Gargana Ganga Sutra. Passing through the triple world, through all the realms of existence, preaching inexhaustibly practicing and renewing his vows, the Bodhisattva attains to enlightenment only through other beings. An exclusive nirvana he renounces, for it is not the true nirvana. He feels all the sins of the world, all its crimes and wickedness are laid upon him. To enlighten others is to purify himself, for he is others. The Arhat ideal of Hinayana may be regarded as the product of the Indian mind when, saturated with an exhausted philosophy, that of the Rishis, and tentatively approaching anew, that of the Buddha, it endeavoured to reconcile the two. It endeavours to reconcile Buddhism with its own doctrine of the divine spark in man, the Purusha, that atom of divinity no bigger than a man's thumb, through which he attains to ecstatic union with the supreme soul of the universe, Parabrahman. Although renouncing the idea that there was anything at all in man which, by ascetic exercises, by meditation, or by devotion, could attain to the mysterious bliss, that everlasting communion, it, the Hinayana, still held the ideal of an individual enlightenment, the Arhat ideal. In Japanese, there is a word which is used to express the idea of emancipation through one's own efforts. The word is jiriki, or self-help. When Buddhism was originally propagated among the peoples of India, it was naturally not accepted by the majority. The Buddha himself said that it was a difficult religion, and difficult it still is. It was accepted only by those with sufficient penetration into the problems of philosophy, with a sufficient grasp of the difficulties in which the Indian religious genius had involved itself, to realize how far the Buddha's religion transcended all that had gone before it. The personal appeal of the Buddha was very great, but it must be remembered that Ananda, his beloved disciple, was almost the last of his disciples to attain to enlightenment, owing to his devotion to the person of the Blessed One. The appeal of Buddhism is to the mind, for it is through the mind and the purification of the mind that the highest enlightenment is attained. But when Buddhism became an accepted religion, when people believed in it, believing what they were taught to believe, without being able to put its profound teachings into actual practice, either through works or through meditation, then Buddhism changed. It became a religion of faith. It veered to the other extreme. It deserted the middle way which the Buddha taught and became as far from it as the Hinayana Arhat ideal. For a thing is as true as its opposite, as we have said. What is this religion of faith? What is its history? Briefly, seeds of it may be found in the Pali Canon, and it is already well developed in the Sanskrit Canon. Imported to China and Japan, it flourished. In Japan, it was propounded by Honen Shonin and by Shinran Shonin. Honen, aware perhaps of the dangers of antinomianism, taught a combination of faith and works, following the Catholic Church in Europe, as a means to attain to salvation. Shonin, however, says in his Gosho Sokushu, quote, "Throw your pride, learning, and metaphysics overboard, and trust to Amida. He will give you everything you need, aye, even the power to believe him, and will take you safe up to heaven." End quote. This heaven is Sukhavati, the land of bliss, which according to various Buddhist sutras, he has established in the West. It will be noted that the emphasis is placed on Amida, not on Shakyamuni, as the object of a religious consciousness. In the sutras, a varying emphasis is placed upon faith and works. In some, even those accepted by Jodoman, the school of Buddhism established by Shonin, it is stated that he who has committed the five sins expressly forbidden by the Blessed One, he will not attain to the pure Western land. Amitabha cannot help him. But in other places in the sutras, it is stated that even he who has committed these sins, nay, even all sins, can attain to Sukhavati through Nembutsu, which is Japanese meaning the invocation in a spirit of perfect trust of the name of Amida. Even at the moment of death, in the midst of all his sins, he can be saved. If only he believes in Amitabha, then all his sins are wiped off the slate, and he can begin afresh in the paradise of the West, being reborn from a lotus, the splendour of which varies as his degree of spiritual enlightenment, or his depravity, varied before his death. The length of time, reckoned not in months but in millions of years, which elapses between his death and rebirth, the length, that is, of his period of gestation in the calyx of the lotus, that also varies in the same way. The more wicked a man during his life, the longer will he have to wait before the pure petals unfold, and before he sees the great bodhisattvas before him, preaching the marvellous law. Jewel trees are there, and silver lakes all full of precious stones, on whose ruffled surface are lotuses of all colours, as large as cartwheels. Heavenly instruments sound, and the music of Dharma reigns through the air. All is peace and plenitude and spiritual progress. It is easier to attain to enlightenment from this land than anywhere else. Quote from a Pure Land Sutra. After long ages, may I blossom forth from thy pure lake of lotuses and stars. The sevenfold curtains shall not shut me out, if thou wilt break for me these sevenfold bars, O Amitabha. Of course, this is only one interpretation of the sutras. Zen understands them quite differently. The sixth patriarch of that sect, Wei Lang, or Hui Neng, says, quote, "According to the sutra spoken by the Bhagavat in Shravasti City for leading people to the Pure Land of the West, it is quite clear that the Pure Land is not far away from here. But when we consider the distance in mileage, it is 108,000, which really represents the 10 evils and 8 errors within us. On this account, we may say that it is far away." End of quote. This is typical of Zen. Slightly humorous and abrupt, it seizes upon the teaching of another sect and remodels it to suit its own purposes. There seems to be a party in Japan at the moment which sees little difference between salvation through faith in Amida and through Christ. But for further information on this subject, see Mori's excellent book, Buddhism and Faith, Tokyo, 1928. It gives a popular account of Amidism and contains, as well, matters of general interest to students of Buddhism. Amidism represents a certain phase of the religious consciousness. This phase is widespread throughout East and West and may be described as the highest level to which popular religion has attained. The multitude of saviour gods, deities who are born, slain and miraculously resurrected, and whose resurrection their votaries share, evince how widely throughout time and space this hunger of the human heart for help has made itself felt. Man manufactures his divinities to suit the needs of that state of spiritual progress to which he has attained. When the disciple is ready, the master will be there. This attainment to salvation through the efforts of another, Japanese Buddhism calls Tariki, other help. Its opposite is Jiriki, or self-help, or the Arhat ideal. These are the two opposite poles of thought. But in the true Bodhisattva ideal, they are reconciled. It all depends, as perhaps all human knowledge depends, upon the point of view we take. In the light of Bodhi, all are seen as impermanent, or anicca, painful, or dukkha, and anatta, or lacking a self. If we regard these two apparently opposite ideals as the expression of the same truth, but from opposite points of view, then we shall be well established on the middle way of Buddhism. And the middle path is near to nirvana. The Arhat ideal regards the processes of salvation from the point of view of the subject. The Tariki ideal regards them from the point of view of the object. One is conscious of saving itself, the other of being saved by another. In the one is the many, in the whole, parts. The Arhat ideal is the abstract idea of the one, the whole, working out its own salvation. The Tariki ideal is the equally abstract idea of the many, the part, attained to that salvation through the activity of the one, the whole. Spinoza said, quote, "The love with which we love God is part of the infinite love wherewith God loves himself." The Amidist might say, quote, "The salvation by which I am saved is part of the infinite salvation by which the Bodhisattva saves himself." Jiriki denies itself. Tariki affirms the other. The former sinks the activity of the object in the subject. The latter does precisely the opposite. One is an exemplification of the via negativa of Western mysticism, the other of the via affirmativa. But what is the meaning of the process of salvation? What does it mean? What have we got when we divorce it from the subjective interpretation of Hinayana and the objective interpretation of extreme Mahayana, in other words, Amidism? The answer is, we have the true Bodhisattva ideal. The truth, said Hegel, is in the whole. We have returned to the middle way. What is this Bodhisattva ideal? It is an ideal depending upon an extremely profound conception of the inmost nature of things. Quote, "He who knows does not speak. He who speaks does not know." All talk about nirvana is from ignorance, not from knowledge. Buddhism is a finger pointing to the moon. Quote, "Silence and a finger pointing the way" is its ideal. Doing, according to our capacity, what the Buddha did, we may experience, according to our capacity, what he experienced. The nature of the highest reality is beyond words. This is fundamental in Buddhism. Nirvana is the solution of an insoluble contradiction. It is the non-solution we reach when there is seen to be no contradiction. This nirvana, whatever it is, the bodhisattva is striving to attain to. But in reality, there is no striving and no attainment. Quote, the essence of mind is intrinsically pure. Nirvana and samsara are the same, an equation perhaps as famous in Mahayana as Berkeley's Esse Est Percipi is in Western philosophy. Note, George Berkeley was an Anglo-Irish philosopher who called his theory immaterialism. Esse Est Percipi, or to be is to be perceived, is the theory that there is no objective material reality, but only ideas in the minds of perceivers. We may regard the whole of this working, suffering world, nay, the whole scheme of things, quote, with all its suns, stars and universes, unquote, as being aspects of a great bodhisattva unceasingly working out his salvation. Actually, of course, sub specie aeternitatis, he is already saved. All things are in nirvana. They stand, quote, in every possible prepositional relationship to void, or shunyata, or nirvana. And ultimately, these two are one. What that one is, we cannot express. The bodhisattva perfects himself by means of the sixfold paramita: dana, or giving; sila, or morality; kushanti, patience or humility; virya, or energy; dhyana, meditation; pranya, wisdom. To these original six, four were later added, the chief of these being upaya, or skillful means. All these, though, the whole ten of them, with all other manifestations of bodhisattva energy, may be regarded as skillful means. Indeed, the whole universe is a great upaya. Seizing upon any one part of it, a bird, a flower, even a philosophical system, and thoroughly understanding it, we may attain to the enlightenment. The following poem is by Tennyson. Flower in the crannied wall, I pluck you out of the crannies. I hold you here, root and all, in my hand. Little flower, but if I could understand what you are, root and all in all, I should know what God and man is. A full explanation of the sixfold paramita will be found in Mrs. Suzuki's Mahayana Buddhism and other manuals. It will be easily seen, though, the whole object of their cultivation is to attain to a state of mind in which the distinction of subject and object, of self and other, I and thou, is not made. They are all other-regarding virtues. We practice them as a means to restore the balance between those great halves into which modern philosophy, beginning with Kant, divides the world. When the I is found in the thou, then indeed time will run back and fetch the age of gold. That's a quote from John Milton. Forgoing self, the universe grows I. That's a quote from Edwin Arnold's The Light of Asia. Steering between the Sila of the Arahant ideal, the solitary negative ideal of Hinayana, and yet avoiding the Charybdis of Amidism, or the jostling rocks of Buddhist metaphysics, we may voyage out into the open sea of being, and realizing the true bodhisattva ideal in our lives, may attain to enlightenment. Quote, peace after war, port after stormy seas, ease after toil, are things that greatly please. quote from Edmund Spenser, The Faery Queen. This is the middle way. This is Buddhism.